from the book of Exodus, second book of the Old Testament, chapter 20. We shall read the first 17 verses, where we have a statement of the Ten Commandments, that summary of the moral law of God. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 1. And God spoke all these words: I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor your alien, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. We should note at this point that the next two commandments, the fifth and the sixth, are particularly relevant to our subject this evening, the topic of euthanasia. Honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And so reads the word of God, and we end our reading at the close of this 17th verse. Tonight, the seventh of our series on current moral issues. I have entitled it, Kindly Death, with a question mark. The word euthanasia literally means a good death, a happy death, a kindly death. That is our subject this evening. There's one great key biblical principle which overarches our whole consideration and must govern it in every respect. It is the sixth commandment, found in Exodus chapter 20, verse 13, where God speaks to all human beings in all ages and says, "You shall not murder." You shall not murder. And yet, people are being killed. And ironically and tragically, they're sometimes being killed in hospitals. Those very buildings dedicated to healing. And they are being killed in ever-increasing numbers. That is our subject this evening. Before coming to it more directly, there are 3 points that I would like to make. I think they're important ones, and I think sometimes as Christians We can be fuzzy or imprecise or even ignorant in our thinking. It is no part of the Christian position that we are in favour of pointless medical treatment which merely prolongs the process of dying. Some Christians speak as if to keep someone in existence is the supreme good for a few hours, a few days, a few weeks longer. That is not so. To prolong the dying process is not to heal, nor in many cases is it to be kind. And we're not arguing for that. Secondly, I believe that in terminal care, when someone is terminally ill, as far as we can tell, the priority of the medical profession should be the comfort of the patient. And if it is the case that it is necessary to administer pain-killing drugs, which may, as a byproduct, shorten the patient's life, provided that the intention is to relieve pain and to provide comfort, from a Christian and ethical position, that is a perfectly proper and right course of treatment. In other words, we have no inhibitions about a doctor caring for a patient in the realm of easing intense pain and making the patient more comfortable. That may have implications for the amount of time the patient will survive, but that is not the main intention of the treatment. And thirdly, as Christians, we do not believe that any treatment should be started or continued unless it is likely to lead to a significant improvement in the patient's condition or in a significant increase in the patient's life expectancy. In other words, as Christians, our respect for the sanctity of life doesn't mean that we want extremely experimental or desperate or very invasive or radical treatments which have very little hope of providing any significant improvement for the patient's care. Sometimes I make these points because sometimes I've heard Christians defending these as being part of the biblical and Christian position, and I don't believe that's the case, and I believe that that brings our whole case into disrepute, because medical people will say, well, these people simply do not understand the situation. Euthanasia has been defined as the intentional killing by act or omission of one whose life is considered not worth living. The intentional killing by act or omission of someone whose life is considered not worth living. It was practiced in the ancient world of Greece and Rome. It has been practiced throughout the world in primitive cultures, and it is now being practiced more and more in the sophisticated West. And just as a tidal wave of abortion is sweeping over our society, so it will be with euthanasia, for the two are closely linked. And I believe that it may well be one of the great moral crises of the early 21st century, which many of you younger people will have to confront and deal with in a very real and pressing way. And we as Christians need to know where we stand on this issue, and if we're against it, as we should be, why we're against it. I want to approach the subject by asking four questions. First of all, what has encouraged euthanasia? What has encouraged euthanasia in our society? Now, there are many things, but I want to suggest three. And first of all, and I believe overwhelmingly the strongest reason, the strongest factor underlying this increase of interest in so-called euthanasia has to be the teaching of the theory of evolution. This has laid the groundwork and created the atmosphere in which the practice of euthanasia has flourished. Evolution teaches that there is nothing special about human life. Human life is just the same as any other life. The life of an animal, the life of a plant, the life of an organism. Human life is no different from the amoeba to human beings. It is essentially the same thing, the same process. Nothing special about human beings. Nothing special about human life. Evolution also teaches that life is the result of the working of a blind, impersonal process in which a key element has been the survival of the fittest. And that is how life is developed. Those organisms that are strong have lived. Those that are weak have died. And this is the secret of progress in human life. And the logic of that is that the unfit should be eliminated. A major new book has been published recently by Michael Burley, in which he deals with the subject of euthanasia in Germany between 1900 and 1945. Now remember that this is long before the advent of Adolf Hitler. And he quotes from the script of a German film made before the Second World War, arguing for euthanasia. And this film shows the inhabitants of psychiatric asylums. This is what the commentary says. "Wherever fate puts us, only the strong will prevail in the end. Everything in the natural world that is weak will be destroyed. In the last few decades, mankind has sinned terribly." Strange word to use. "Mankind has sinned terribly against the law of natural selection. We haven't just maintained life unworthy of life. We have even allowed it to multiply. The descendants of sick people look like this." Then the camera closed in on the members of the psychiatric asylums. That was the argument. We haven't just maintained life unworthy of life. We have allowed it to multiply. We have sinned against the law of natural selection. Now that has been taught and expressed and promoted in all of culture for over 100 years. And when that goes on and on, life is bound to be cheap. So I would place the great responsibility on the teaching of the theory of evolution. A second factor is that of medical advance. The problem that we have now, ironically enough, is a problem of success. The advances in medical technology and science have been so remarkable in this century that they have greatly extended the span of human life. The average life expectancy now in the United Kingdom is 81 for women and 78 for men. This is a very long lifespan in historical terms, and we should be very, very grateful for the advances in modern medicine, where folk in their 70s and their 80s are able to lead very active, fruitful, useful, enjoyable and fulfilling lives in many cases. It's a wonderful thing. In previous generations, a person who was 60 was old. Nowadays they're thought of as entering early middle age. That has been a great change. But it means that the population is becoming more elderly, that there are many more old and frail people, that some diseases which previously proved fatal are now not fatal, and people are able to survive them. And the issue of health care for the frail becomes more and more pressing. A third factor which has encouraged evolution is the culture of selfishness in which we live. The great gods of our age are personal pleasure and materialism. That is what people worship. Pleasure and money. Now, disabled people, frail people, unwell people threaten those idols. In the terms of modern society, they are a nuisance. They're a nuisance. And they are expensive. And in this sinful world in which we live, the attitude is they're better out of the way. They spoil our fun and they cost us money. Get rid of them. If unwanted babies can be killed, why not unwanted sick people? Why not unwanted old people? If abortion can invade one end of life, why not euthanasia at the other end? This is the poisonous atmosphere we live in, and it infects the thinking and approach of many people. So these are underlying factors which encourage evolution. But of course, people don't quote these. People don't say which encourage euthanasia. People don't say I'm in favour of euthanasia because I believe in the theory of evolution. Or they don't say I'm in favour of euthanasia because I'm selfish. So we come to our second question. How is euthanasia defended? What arguments do people use? Let me mention three. It's first of all defended on the grounds of compassion. Of compassion. It's called sometimes mercy killing. The showing of mercy. People say, if you had a sick animal, what would you do? If a horse breaks its leg, if you have a household pet, and the pet is old and frail and obviously in pain, what do? You take it along to the vet. You have it put down. It would be cruel to let it go on living in pain. The phrase people use is, you put it out of its misery. That's the kind thing to do. We all agree with that. With an animal. And people say, well, if you would do it for an animal, why would you not do it for a person? What's the point of useless suffering? What's the point of letting people linger on in agony? Month after month. Suffering for no purpose and no benefit. Is it not far kinder? Is it not the compassionate thing to bring their pain to an end, to put them out of their misery? Mercy killing. It's defended on the grounds of compassion. It's defended on the grounds of individual rights. Some people have signed living wills, so-called. They've said, if I should become ill, I do not want such and such a treatment to be taken. I want to be allowed to die. Some people have expressed similar wishes. And the argument goes, is that not up to them? Is it not up to the individual to decide how and when he or she dies? In 1972, there was a very famous and influential television play, which was later made into a film. The title was, Whose Life Is It Anyway? Whose Life Is It Anyway? The main character in the play was a young man who was in a motor accident and was left paralysed from the neck down. And the whole play was about his wish to die, and the doctor who would not allow him to die. And how this man didn't want to live, and his rights, his wishes, were disregarded and overruled by people who thought they knew better. And so people say, whose life is it? It's my life. And if I want it to come to an end, I have the right to ask for it to be brought to an end. And my wishes should be respected. There's the compassion argument. There's the argument of individual rights. And thirdly, there is the economic argument. And that is an argument which is strengthening. The health service is facing a financial crisis. In 1993-94, the National Health Service cost £29 billion. £29,000 million. And everyone is saying that this cannot be allowed to go on. More and more health treatments are available. Technology is becoming increasingly expensive. People say we can't go on piling money into the health service, into keeping people alive. In 1990, the average person under 64 cost the National Health Service £178. The average person over 75 cost the health service £1,186, nearly 10 times as much. And people are saying there are young people who need kidney machines. They can't get them. There are people who need transplants. They can't get them. We need more orthopaedic surgeons. We haven't got them. We need more nurses. We haven't got them. Is it right for resources to be spent on people who are terminally ill, for whom there is no hope of improvement, who have lived a good span of life? Is it right for resources to be spent on them, leaving other people without the necessary resources? Prioritisation. That's the word. These are three of the arguments that are used. Euthanasia is defended on the grounds of compassion, individual rights, and economics. Now, all these arguments can be answered. I'll not take time to answer them all in detail. But human beings are not animals. And they're not to be put down like animals. And it simply is not true that most people who are seriously ill are in great pain. Nowadays, pain is very, very skillfully managed and controlled, and great advances have been made, so that most pain can be medicated and controlled. To whom is mercy killing merciful? Many people who are seriously ill are not distressed. They're not anxious. They're not obviously suffering. It is more painful for their relatives and their friends to have to watch them. But the person himself is not distressed. How does one define a life which is not worth living? Who says it's not worth living? The onlooker? Supposing a person says, I want to die, and then later changes their mind. How many thousands of people have done that? What about the person who's temporarily depressed or suicidal? Are you going to give them their rights? Are you going to let them kill themselves? We could argue on. We talk about a health crisis, a financial crisis in the health service. How much money is spent every week on a foolish lottery? How much money is spent on tobacco and alcohol and entertainment? Plenty of money for these things. But apparently not enough money to care for the needy. So these arguments could be answered. We need to know them. We need to be able to answer them. But I want to go on and suggest in the third place that we oppose euthanasia not just because of these feeble arguments which are raised in favour of it, but to ask thirdly, what are the dangers of euthanasia? What are the dangers of euthanasia? Let me suggest four. They're all obvious. There is the danger of abuse. There's the danger of abuse by healthy relatives and friends in a culture where it is permissible to bring human life to an end. What about those people who want to be free from the duty of caring for dependent relatives, or who want access to their money? An old person is in a nursing home and it's costing so many £100 a week, and the family are having to visit and they're seeing their inheritance eaten away week after week after week, and they say to each other, there's going to be nothing left. Would it not be better if father or mother was put out of the way? If treatment was stopped, if more active measures be taken. Now, it's a shocking thing to have to say this, but we live in a wicked world. We live in an evil, selfish, greedy world. And once you start entrusting the power of life and death to sinful, selfish human beings, you are on an extremely slippery slope. And the dangers of abuse are not just hypothetical, they are certain. In a culture of euthanasia, it will be abused. Of that, you can be sure. It's being abused now. How much more the case when those who are expensive and inconvenient are vulnerable? Friends, the system will be abused. They will be put out of the way. That's what will happen. A second danger is the danger of pressure. Pressure on the disabled, on the infirm. As it is borne home to them that they are being a burden, that they are in the way, that they're not wanted, that they're a nuisance. In a culture of euthanasia, that is the atmosphere. Why are you still here? What good are you? You're in the way. Can you imagine the horror of a disabled person being made to feel that? Imagine facing that pressure when you're weak, when you're very old. Someone has put it memorably this way. In a culture of euthanasia, the right to die will become the duty to die. The right to die. That's what they're talking about now. We want people to have the right to die. Mark my words. If this culture spreads, that right to die will become a duty to die. A powerful pressure on vulnerable, lonely people to take themselves out of the way so that the fittest can survive and enjoy life. A third danger, damage to the doctor-patient relationship. Throughout history, the doctor, the nurse, have always been seen as healers, carers, those who are on the side of the patient, who will seek the patient's good. The sick have felt, there is someone who will stand up for me. There is someone who will represent my interests, who will be on my side, seeking my welfare above all else. Right back to the Hippocratic Oath. I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest such counsel. But in a culture of euthanasia, the doctor becomes not only a healer, but a killer. We saw that film, some of us from Holland, last spring on BBC television. The doctor comes as a killer. Think about that for a moment. Think about the frail, disabled person. One day, son or daughter comes in and says, "You haven't been too well. I'm going to have the doctor come in and see you today." Imagine the pang of fear. Why is the doctor coming? The specter of people hiding their disabilities. Afraid to ask for the doctor. Afraid to see the doctor's visit, to have a doctor's visit. Keeping up a front. Not acknowledging their weaknesses. Not telling anybody about their pain. If people know how frail I am, I'll send for the doctor. It's a horror. The danger of abuse by selfish and greedy people. The danger of pressure, terrible pressure, on the vulnerable and weak. The danger of damage to doctor-patient relationships. And then fourthly, and most terribly of all, euthanasia is dangerous because of what it may lead to. And we don't need to guess at this, because we have a recent historical parallel in Germany between 1920 and 1945. There's a popular idea that millions of Jews were killed because of Nazism, and that once Nazism was dealt with, the problem was dealt with. That's not true. There was a program of killing going on in Germany before the war started, which had nothing to do with the Jews. There had been propaganda in Germany for over 20 years saying that the weak should be eliminated. And before the start of World War II, Adolf Hitler had started what he called a program of eugenics. And in that program, 275,000 Germans were killed in extermination centres. These were not Jews, these were not gypsies, these were not prisoners of war. These were German people who weren't fit to live. Hitler started off with the aged, the infirm, the senile, the mentally retarded, and defective children. And these people were taken to camps and killed. But he didn't stop there. The program went on to epileptics, soldiers who had lost limbs in the First World War, children who wet the bed, and children with badly modelled ears. I'm not making this up. This happened in Germany. They weren't perfect. They were defective. Kill them. And his plan was to kill all the Jews and all the Poles, and to reduce the population of Russia by 30 million people, because there were too many Russians. It started as something small. It grew to a horrible nightmare. We're aware of the situation in Holland. At least we can only guess how many people are killed, because most of the cases are not reported. On the 21st of June 1994, a case came before the Dutch Supreme Court. A woman had been depressed over the death of her two sons, and she wanted to end her life. A psychiatrist provided her with the drugs to do so, and he helped her to kill herself. She was perfectly healthy. She had nothing physically wrong with her. A middle-aged woman who was naturally sad over the loss of her sons, and the psychiatrist helped her to kill herself. And the Dutch Supreme Court was asked to rule whether he had committed an offence. And the court ruled that in future, the advice of a second psychiatrist needed to be sought to confirm that the patient was making a voluntary request. And provided that, two psychiatrists agreed that a patient wanted to end his or her life, they were quite free to provide that person with the means for ending their life. irrespective of their state of physical health. Now you see, that will happen. If euthanasia gets a hold in our society, that will happen. It will spread and spread and spread until we have a Holocaust. Old people, frail people. And then what about people who are handicapped? We don't want them. People who are defective in some way. People who are insane. People who are depressed. Why stop there? What about people who are unemployable? What about criminals? We'd be better off without them. What about racial minorities? What about religious minorities? People have delusions that there's somebody up in heaven. I think they're talking to them. They'd be better out of the way. Where can you stop? In 1967, when they brought in the Abortion Act, they said, this isn't going to increase the number of abortions at all. We want to reduce the number of abortions. There won't be an increase. Perhaps a very few more. We know what happened. Millions more. The thing just mushroomed out of control. And now unborn babies are being slaughtered in their millions. We're hearing the same arguments now. It's only for a very unusual case. It's only for something that would happen once in a blue moon, for a Tony Bland type of very difficult, painful situation. It won't stop there. It won't stop there. It will go on until it's a monster. And that brings us lastly to the practical question. What can we do about euthanasia? What can we do about euthanasia? Well, first of all, we can be informed and we can protest as citizens of this country to be alert, to be active, to know what's happening, to write to our MPs, to write to our newspapers, to support in every way possible those forces which are pro-life, and to resist the insidious spread of this demonic passion for killing. There's a very aggressive pro-euthanasia lobby, organizations like Exit, urging it, working for it, advertising, propagandizing, trying to spread it. We need to be as active in response. Secondly, we need to stand up against our culture by honouring the elderly. By honouring the elderly. In Leviticus 19:32, here's what God says. Rise in the presence of the aged. Show respect for the elderly and revere your God. Proverbs 16:31, grey hair is a crown of splendor. Our culture values young people. Young people. The Bible values old people. Old people. A crown of splendor. Show respect for the elderly. We need a counterculture. We need a different attitude. 1 Timothy 5:1, Paul says to the young pastor, do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat older women as mothers. As if they were your father. As if they were your mother. My friends, the elderly are treasures. Treasures of experience and knowledge and wisdom and information on which we can draw. They can tell us so much. They can share so much with us. The Bible tells us that they are to be respected and honored and cherished and given an important place. Not pushed out of the way. Not knocked down in the rush for pleasure.
No.
It's so different. The promise of the fifth commandment, not only for an individual but for a nation. Honor your father and mother so that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God gives you. If God spares us, we'll all be elderly someday. We want to live in a world where they're honored, respected. And then thirdly, we must care for the disabled. We must care for the disabled. God does. God cares for the disabled. In the Old Testament law in Leviticus 19:14, he says, "Do not curse the deaf, or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God. I am the Lord." These disabled people, he says, don't treat them as a nuisance. Don't get impatient with them or aggravated with them. Don't curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God. I am the Lord. My dear friends, we are all handicapped. We're all defective. We're all disabled, aren't we? We were all blind. We were all deaf. We were all crippled. We were all mad in sin. Weak, frail, defective creatures. God didn't embark on a euthanasia program. God embarked on a caring program with the very blood of His Son. People say, should you keep someone alive if they need a life support system? We all need a life support system. And God has provided an eternal life support system. Everlasting life. God sent His Son to save us, frail, dying, defective, disabled people. He loved us and pitied us and cared for us and redeemed us by sending His Son. And surely we who are Christians, of all people, should care for the disabled. We should have endless reserves of patience. We should regard no human being as beyond our care and attention. Could I put in a quick plea here for the excellent work of the hospice in Northern Ireland? This would be a very practical way of showing concern in this area. They're having a sponsored walk in a few weeks. If you felt like giving to their funds, they need money. I talked yesterday on Friday to the doctor in charge. They have a shop in Glengormley. They need volunteers to help man that shop, even for a couple of hours a week. They need people to look after their garden. They need people to man the tea bar in the hospice. They need people to just sit and spend time with the terminally ill. To give them something to drink, their mouths are dry. To care for them in practical ways. Could some of you be involved in that work? Could you show care for the dying? The number's in the book, 781-836. Ask for the volunteer manager or the shop manager, and they'll send you an application form, and they'll give you an interview to see if you could help. Would that be a practical way in which some of us could fight against euthanasia? It's a simple fact. In Holland, there are practically no hospices. In America, there are very few hospices. In Great Britain, there's a strong hospice movement. And the experts tell us that in every country where there's a strong hospice movement, there's much less support for the euthanasia movement. It's one of the best and most practical ways of taking a stand and doing something. And then, of course, as always, but it's crucial, we do need to pray. We do need to witness. We need a massive spiritual revolution in our nation. The wages of sin are death, but the gift of God is eternal life. The devil comes to kill and to destroy. This is devilish. It is devilish. And we are pro-life, for we have life in Christ. May God help us to show it by our actions and by our lives. Amen. Let us bow in prayer. Our Father in heaven, we thank you that you have cared for the spiritually handicapped, that you looked upon us in all our brokenness and in all our need, that you were never tempted to sweep us away, to eliminate us and to start again. But slowly and patiently, you put the broken pieces together. You spend our whole lives restoring us. And it took the death of your Son to do so.